Hey, folks, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. This is Grant Padalko. I'm an editor at rferl.org, and I'll be your host again this week. You know, I'm not sure how much longer we can really call this podcast new, since this is our 12th show, which gives me a good excuse to thank everyone who's been listening, either by downloading The Blender from RFERL's website or by subscribing on iTunes.
People ask me all the time what my favorite podcast is, and my answer to that question is yours, of course.
Oh, hey, man, thanks. That's much appreciated. And now let me give you a preview of some of the stories we have on this week's show. We visit the musicians of Karabat Street in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The street, once the spiritual home of Afghanistan's rich classical music tradition, is suffering after years of war, Taliban edicts, and the emigration of its finest talents.
The musicians of Karabat have been forgotten. Our living conditions are very bad. Our economic conditions are bad. Nobody's paying attention to us.
Speaking from exile in the Czech Republic, former Belarusian presidential candidate Aleš Mikhailovich says he believes the authorities in Minsk have presented the opposition with a grand moment to unify.
Even people like me, who are ready to work with the government, are being driven by it into open, radical opposition. So I think that precisely after the 19th of December, after that night of mass arrests and cracked heads, unifying will be much more likely.
And staying on the topic of Belarus, writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick caught up with acclaimed British playwright Tom Stoppard. Stoppard has been championing the causes of free speech and democracy in Belarus since 2005 and believes that President Alexander Lukashenko is playing the West for a fool.
My own view is, and I am an amateur here, but my own view is that he's played his hand a lot better than Europe has. I mean, he's made monkeys out of us.
But first to the high seas. It sounds like the plot of an adventure novel. Sailors trapped for months on a ship without food, supplies, or navigation equipment, forced to fish in order to survive. But it's the real-life experience of one Georgian ship, the Vasilios N, which was held in Libya for 11 months before making a dramatic escape in early March. Daisy Sindelar has the story.
In the busy port of Valletta on the island nation of Malta, a nine-man crew of Georgians, Ukrainians, and an Azeri perform daily chores on board their ship as they wait to go home. The men are a little impatient, but that's because they've just spent more than a year at sea, including 11 months trapped in the Libyan port of Misrata, where they were detained with little food and no money until the war in that country allowed them to stage a dramatic escape. Their misadventure began when their ship, the Vasilios N, was caught in a violent Mediterranean storm. The squall sent 7-meter waves crashing over the deck. When the skies cleared 3 days later, the sailors discovered water had leaked into the hold, damaging their cargo of nearly 5,000 tons of cement powder. When the Vasilios got to Misrata, the Libyan buyer rejected the delivery and got a court order placing the ship under arrest until its owners paid him back for the damage. The Vasilios crew settled in for what they thought would be a short wait. But after 6 months, says crew member Georgi Kurashvili, they realized the ship's Greek and Italian owners had abandoned the case, leaving the sailors to fend for themselves.
It was very difficult. We kept telling the owners that we had no food, but they paid absolutely no attention. We told them that almost every member of the crew was in need of medical help. They did not even consider us worthy of a reply. The captain and the first mechanic were fishing, and that's all we had, fish. That's how we survived.
The situation grew rapidly worse. The sailors had little communication with their families back home and no fuel to heat the boat as the winter weather turned colder. One night, a crew member who had threatened suicide set fire to the operations cabin, attempting to burn the boat down. The fire was put out before anyone was hurt, but the ship's navigational equipment was destroyed. Meanwhile, the world outside was growing more difficult as well. Ripples of the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt were spreading throughout the Middle East, By March, protests against Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi had escalated into full-scale clashes between government forces and rebel fighters. News of the war filled family members back in Georgia with dread. For Manana Ambalia, two of the most important people in her life were on board the Vasilios. Her son, Georgi, and her husband, Iveri, the ship's captain. Reading a journal entry from the time, Ambalia describes her ordeal.
I've memorized the events in Libya by heart. There is fighting going on in Benghazi, in Ras Lanuf. I'm writing down the names and trying to figure out which one is closest to where the ship is. And then I hear that Misurata 2 is getting bombed. It's as if I'm paralyzed. I lock myself in my room and think what awaits me. And then an appalling thought crosses my mind, a thought which I can only now confess. I catch myself thinking, whose life I want more, my husband's or my son's? Saying this makes me sick even now.
As events grew more tense, Ukrainian diplomats in Misrata approached the boat, offering to evacuate the entire crew and send them home. The sailors were overjoyed, but suddenly the diplomats scaled back their offer, saying they could take only their own citizens. The three Ukrainian sailors refused. One of them, Artyom Slabospitsky, explains why.
We are all sailors, and we are one crew on one ship, so we are one family. If someone were to leave the ship, it would be wrong as a human being and wrong as a sailor. It's a long-standing law of the sea. It's everyone or no one. And purely in terms of the human factor, how could we do that? Get off and leave our friends and colleagues behind to be bombed? That's not how it's done.
So the crew stayed on. The fighting in Misrata grew more intense. Shells fired by Gaddafi's forces began to target the port and even hit some of the boats. But the fighting provided an opportunity. As the violence worsened, the port authorities that had once kept a watchful eye on the Vasilios seemed to vanish. And on the night of March 8th, Georgi Kurashvili watched, astonished, as another ship pulled silently out of the port, staging a secret retreat. Georgi quickly woke the crew. Within minutes, they were in agreement. It was now or never. Soon, says the captain, Iveri Kurashvili, the Vasilios was chugging quietly through the port gates as the sailors anxiously scanned the shore for any sign their escape had been detected.
And then suddenly I saw that the ship had stalled. The angle of the propeller blades was at zero. We found out that the pump had been switched off. So we switched it on and left. Of course it was frightening. We were all very afraid. But what can you do? Fear can't stop death. In a day and a half, we were already waiting for inspection in Malta.
With the ship's navigational equipment destroyed by fire, Iveri Kurashvili was forced to fall back on more traditional methods to find his way to Malta. Recalling his lessons as a Naval Academy student, he used a sextant, a compass, and the stars to chart his course. The crew now say they feel lucky to have left Libya when they did, but it still may be months before they're free to travel home. Altogether, they're owed more than $250,000 in unpaid wages. With the ship's owners absent, the sailors have hired a lawyer and are hoping to sell the Vasilios in order to get their money. Back in Georgia, Manana's nightmarish year of uncertainty is over. Her son, Georgi, and her husband, Iveri, are both safe and easy to contact. In frequent phone calls, she asks Iveri the same question over and over. How did he manage to leave Libya? How did he escape? His answer, she says, is always the same. God gave me a chance, and I took it.
That was Daisy Sindelar reporting on the 11-month ordeal of a Georgian ship trapped in the Libyan port of Misurata. She reported the story together with Teya Absaridze of our Georgian service. For more on the story of the Vasilios N, including a photo gallery of the ship and its crew, visit our website at rferl.org. Harabat Street in Kabul was once the heart of Afghanistan's classical music tradition, but years of war, emigration, and Taliban rule fractured the community and its musical heritage. The musicians of Kharabat now wonder how to make themselves heard in a changing culture. Jeremy Branston reports.
My name is Muhammad Hanif. I'm the son of famous musician Ghulam Hassan. My father was a student of Muhammad Omar, the most famous master of this instrument, the rabab.
Hanif is part of a community of Afghan musicians based in Kuch-e-Kharabat, or Kharabat Street, in Kabul. Their traditions stretch back to the mid-19th century, when Afghan kings invited musicians from India to play for the royal court. A unique culture soon developed around Kharabat Street, where classical musicians passed on their skills and practice of Sufi Islam to the next generation. But in the 1990s, during Afghanistan's civil war, Kharabat Street became a front line between warring factions in Kabul. Much of the neighborhood was destroyed. Artists like Hanif fled to Pakistan to escape the Taliban regime, which imposed a total ban on instrumental music and punished anyone caught playing. By the time Hanif returned in 2002, after 14 years in exile, he found that the musical life of Kharabat Street had changed forever.
The musicians of Kharabat have been forgotten. Our living conditions are very bad. Our economic conditions are bad. Nobody's paying attention to us. Many people can't afford their own houses, and they can only rent. It's really awful.
Many musicians are affected by the changes in Afghan culture after years of instability. Asad Kasimi once studied with one of the masters of Kharabat Street, Ustad Kasim Bakhsh. But he also fled Afghanistan in the 1990s. Now, back in Kabul, he worries that Afghan classical music is overshadowed by pop videos and foreign influences.
Today, most Afghan musicians look to Tajikistan and Pakistan, abandoning the millennium old traditions of Afghan music. Today, we have left behind the traditional Afghan instruments, the rabab and tabla, and singers depend on female dancers from Tajikistan to make the music appealing. The current singers pay no attention to classical poetry. I want Afghan artists to make music videos that are in line with our Afghan and Islamic values.
As classical music falls into obscurity, Kasimi says that highly trained musicians no longer get the respect they deserve and are relegated to low-paid and rowdy gigs.
I want the Afghan government to send night police patrols to private wedding parties. They should see what happens at these events. We have to read dedications to the guests and sing rubbish songs. We are musicians, but very few people at those parties are interested in listening to genuine music from Kharabat. When this is the culture of our city, how can an Afghan musician succeed in promoting Afghan music?
Hanif believes that the classical music traditions of Kharabat Street can survive in a changing Afghanistan, but it might take some outside support to bring new talent to this old community.
My main professional concern is that we need to have a music school that can keep up with international standards and where young men and women can come and learn from us.
That story was produced by Abubakar Siddiq and Saijan Sabawoon. Born in Zlín in the former Czechoslovakia in 1937, Tom Stoppard is one of the world's most celebrated playwrights. He's the author of such acclaimed works as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, Arcadia, and Rock and Roll, which details the lives of a set of Czech dissidents from the 1960s until the fall of the Soviet Union. In recent years, Stoppard has made common cause with opposition activists in Belarus. Stoppard spoke with writer-at-large Jamie Kirchick in a bustling café on the sidelines of the International Affairs Conference called the Brussels Forum.
And you wrote in The Independent a couple weeks ago that this is almost an embarrassment for Europe.
Well, I believe it is. I think there is an element of... I think that people are slightly embarrassed to actually have Belarus put on their agenda again and again, because they don't know what to do about Belarus. They talk a good game. It's quite long-term. It's quite abstract. But in the meantime, Lukashenko does pretty much what he wants to do.
You're an artist. You don't claim to have the answers as you did today. You said you were depressed.
I do not claim to have the answers. Yes, coffee would be good. Cappuccino, thank you so much. Somebody said yesterday, you know, that if there were people dying in the main square in Belarus, then something would be done. In other words, there are things which would be done in other circumstances, which is a situation you would need, for example, Joseph Heller to do justice to that. You know who I mean, don't you? Catch 22. Because one is, or Jonathan Swift, say. I mean, it's like saying, well, we can't really get deeply involved because, you know, nobody's dead, nobody's being killed. It's not actually true. There have been people killed, but they're not being killed on television.
Lukashenko's wily enough, smart enough to know not to pull the guns out.
My own view is, and I am an amateur here, but my own view is that he's played his hand a lot better than Europe has. I mean, he's made monkeys out of us, encouraged us enough when it suited him, turned around to face the other way, leaving Europe looking a little foolish, frankly.
You spoke in your speech about that standards were falling in the West. Could you just elaborate on that?
I'm reluctant to, because to try to compress what I was referring to into a soundbite.
It doesn't have to be a soundbite.
Well, more or less. You know, it's not just Europe. In a certain sense, the imminent elections in Russia are about as fake as the election in Belarus. It's just a different kind of fake. That's what I mean about saying that it's not as though Belarus were an anomaly in the map of utopia. Look at Italy. You know, if one starts talking about corruption and control of the media, you could leave that country blank and you could write in Belarus. In a different sense, you could write in Italy. In a different sense, you could... I mean, even in England, media monopoly is an issue with Murdoch and BSB Sky. So trying to get perfect democratic society, trying to get that blueprint to come alive is very, very hard when you're trying to reconcile it with the freedom to be a media baron.
You speak to a lot of young people, theater students, you say. Do you sense a sense of complacency when it comes to Belarus, Russia, the problems, these problems?
Listen, the students, it's not complacency, it's just that they don't know. They don't know about it. Very few know about it. I tell you, why would they know? Belarus is barely a story now. It's completely overwhelmed by much more photogenic stories in North Africa. But I'm not complaining about that. It's the nature of the beast.
Right.
But the people at the conference on whose desks there's the Belarus dossier, and it's those people one is talking to. You know, what actually are you going to do?
That was Jamie Kirchick talking to playwright Tom Stoppard. You can find Jamie's full interview with Stoppard on our website at rferl.org.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast.
In December, former Belarusian presidential candidate Aleš Mikhailovich was arrested along with fellow candidates and hundreds of supporters as they protested against the controversial re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko. After 2 months in jail, Mikhailovich fled Minsk in March and was granted political asylum in the Czech Republic. In an exclusive interview with Radio Free Europe, Mikhailovich vowed to pursue justice after the government's crackdown and said he sees a moment of opportunity for the opposition. Richard Solash reports.
Anais Mikhailevich woke up on Belarus's election day, December 19, 2010, as one of nine candidates vying to replace President Alexander Lukashenko, the man known as Europe's last dictator. Some 24 hours later, after a violent crackdown by the authorities on citizen protests against election fraud, Mikhailevich began his day in jail, along with other top candidates and some 700 supporters. The crackdown generated international condemnation and a fresh round of sanctions on Minsk by Brussels and Washington. Now, the 35-year-old Mikhailevich is hundreds of kilometers from home in the Czech Republic, which granted him political asylum on March 24th. He told RFERL that from the safety of the European Union, he will devote his energy to activism and work to hold the Lukashenko regime accountable.
For the moment, I'm working more as a public activist. As a lawyer, I would like to make use of all international legal mechanisms. And I've discovered that there are many of them, because this isn't just about political prisoners. It's about torture in Europe on the borders of the European Union. I want to use my experience and knowledge in order to stop torture and ensure that there are no longer political prisoners in Belarus. I'm not thinking so much about my future political career.
Mikhailevich was discharged from a Minsk detention center on February 19th, but only after he consented to sign an agreement to collaborate with state security, or the KGB. In actuality, he said he never has and never would work with the security forces. I would be afraid, above all, of not being able to look my friends in the eyes if I became an agent of the KGB, he told RFERL. He added, I signed that document on cooperation, knowing that I would immediately call a press conference and explain that I was in investigative custody and signed such a document. Mikhailevich told reporters after his release that the conditions in jail were like a concentration camp. He said guards made him stand naked outdoors in freezing temperatures, deprived him of sleep, dragged him across the floor while handcuffed, kept him in an overcrowded cell, and interrogated him without a lawyer. Recalling the experience, Mikhailevich said he knew that less well-known prisoners probably experience even worse conditions.
One of the main conclusions I reached was that if they're going to publicly torture and mistreat former presidential candidates and public figures, understanding full well that sooner or later those people are going to talk about it, I could only imagine what would happen with former customs officials or law enforcement officers they're mistreating, understanding full well that no one is going to intercede on their behalf. Because who in our society is going to say, oh, what a pity, they're mistreating customs officials?
Mikhailevich said he also knew that regardless of what happened to him while he was in custody, he'd already become a thorn in the side of the Lukashenko regime, a role he says he now plans to expand by working closely with international rights groups.
The authorities were in a situation where anything that they did with me would be bad. If they put me in jail, that would have created some bad publicity. If I stayed in Belarus, that would have been bad because they would have had to conduct a serious investigation into the acts of torture I talked about at the news conference after my release. The fact that I left is also bad because I am now working with international organizations, with lawyers, and with the United Nations commissioners on questions of torture.
Mikhailevich told RFERL that because the authorities had prohibited him from leaving Belarus, when he decided to leave the country, he left his mobile phone in Minsk, suspecting that the KGB uses people's phone signals to track them. He said a friend drove him into Russian territory and then into Ukraine. With his current passport in police custody, he used an old passport at the border crossings. In Kiev, Mikhailevich got in touch with several embassies, but the Czechs agreed pretty quickly, he said, to issue him an entry visa. The former presidential candidate said he intends to return to Minsk as soon as possible, as soon as such an opportunity presents itself. But he said he doesn't rule out trying to have his family, a wife and two daughters, join him abroad. According to the Belarusian news agency Belapan, the country's top prosecutor is likely to ask the Czech Republic to extradite Mikhailevich. Meanwhile, in Minsk, fellow former presidential candidates Andrei Sannikau and Mikhailai Statkevich remain in prison. Another ex-candidate, Uladzimir Nakhlyayu, remains under house arrest. More than 40 protesters have been charged with instigating mass disorder, and several have already been jailed for up to 4 years. But Mikhailevich said that as the repression continues, Lukashenko is unwittingly helping the opposition.
I think that Lukashenko is now doing a lot to help the opposition unify. It's always easier to unify against someone. I was a very soft candidate. I didn't criticize Lukashenko. I simply said that I had a different program, that the present government doesn't have answers to most of the questions, but that the government undoubtedly had done some good things in the past. Even people like me, who are ready to work with the government, are being driven by it into open, radical opposition. So I think that precisely after the 19th of December, after that night of mass arrests and cracked heads, unifying will be much more likely.
That was Richard Solash reporting. The interview with Mikhailovich was conducted by Andrei Shari of our Russian service.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Це Радіо Фарда Кушніка.
А ще Радіо Європа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатить Радіо.
Азатицюн ГТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
And that's all the time we have for this week. Don't forget to check out rferl.org for more about these and many other stories from our vast broadcast region. This week's podcast was edited by Tanya Kancheva. If you've got a comment about the blender, good or bad, we can take it. Send it to podcast@rferl.org or leave a message on the blender blog at rferl.org. Until next week, this is Grant Padalko. Take care, everybody.